Tonight's meal, tilapia surprise with boiled cabbage. Begin cooking steps 1 through 50 now.
Are you kidding me? Making dinner shouldn't feel like doing a 1,000-piece puzzle. With Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals, the hard part's already done. Pre-chopped ingredients, zero stress. Just assemble, bake, and enjoy. No complicated steps, no mountain of dishes. Try Assemble and Bake today. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Good morning, folks. Thursday, January 8th. We're on our countdown to a new administration coming into the city of New Orleans. Hoorah! Can't wait till Monday at 9 a.m. at the Sanger. Helena Moreno will take the oath of office and we'll be off and running with a new administration. In my view, it cannot come fast enough. At 12 o'clock, Rafael Goyeneche, President of Metropolitan Crime Commission, will join us. We'll look back in 2025 year in review as it relates to the New Orleans criminal justice system. At 11:30, Russell Richardson, President and CEO of the St. Tammany Economic Development Corporation, will join us about their accomplishments in 2025 and what they see headed their way and the opportunities of 2026. Chief Ann Kirkpatrick at the top of the 11 o'clock hour, NOPD superintendent. She'll join us. We'll talk about crime stats. We'll talk about a number of other issues impacting the NOPD, and we'll get her thoughts on same. Amy McCarron, New Orleans City Council District A, newly elected, will take the oath of office on Monday as well. She declared victory with a 59% of the vote. And so I think it's my first opportunity to talk to Amy as an elected, someone that's been elected to the council. So we look forward to that. I don't even know where to start on this topic because there's so many different stories going on in Minneapolis, going on in Minnesota. They all kind of bleed into one another, but it's getting absolutely crazy. And I guess I'll start with Governor Tim Walz's comments. Do you have no decency? Do you have no decency? We have someone dead in their car for no reason whatsoever. Really? And I don't want to be right about this, but I said if they do this, they're going to create a chaotic situation where someone innocent is going to get killed. And they did it. Now we hear more political rhetoric. I didn't know that there was political rhetoric around enforcement of laws. And I have been totally consistent on this. Both sides, critical of the right, critical of the left. As an elected official, you do not get to choose which laws you are going to enforce. You take an oath to enforce them all. And what makes this whole matter even worse, the primary mission of Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol and HSI is to defend the homeland and to enforce the laws on the books relative to immigration. How someone can stand up there in an elected position as a governor of a state and say to a federal law enforcement authority, do you have no decency for doing and enforcing the laws, which is their primary mission? They would be less than if they did nothing. And I guess that's what they expect them to do. Nothing. They don't like the fact that they're in these cities. And it's interesting about Democrats, right? If you recall not too many years ago, let's take a walk back on the trail of history. Democrats were very much opposed to state and local government getting involved in immigration. They didn't want it. No, this was carved out to the federal government. And the federal government alone. In fact, they went to court on this issue. But here we are years later because it works for their political rhetoric that they're standing up for someone who's in this country illegally. Now, that doesn't make much sense to me at all. How do you want it? You can't have it both ways. This is absolutely ridiculous. This governor is a complete total embarrassment. Decency? It's indecent to enforce the laws of the United States, the laws of the respective state that you're in, the laws of the the city, the municipality. It's indecent to do all of that? Or is that just carved out for any organization that might be associated with the Donald Trump administration, which is more of the Trump derangement syndrome? What is it? Who is in the best position to avoid what is going on in the streets of this country? First, the illegal immigrant who decides to come across the border and violate the laws of the United States. That person is in the best position to do the right thing and not create a situation that might bring inconvenience, if you want to call it that, arrest, and deportation of oneself and their family. We talk about splitting families up. I am sick and tired of hearing that. Every time we made an arrest, in the 90s, we'd make 30,000 felony arrests a year. We split up 30,000 families. You see people going to the streets, humming rocks and snowballs and knocking windows out of JPSO vehicles. No, because we're supposed to be a nation of laws. I was elected, my predecessor Harry Lee was elected to enforce the laws of the state of Louisiana and the laws of the parish of Jefferson. That was supposed to be the social contract. That's the understanding of how this whole thing is set up. All of a sudden now, this is not vogue. It's indecent. Who's the second person to be in line that their action can ensure that stuff like this wouldn't happen? How about the governor of the state of Minnesota? And how about the mayor of Minneapolis? Neither one of them honor ICE detainers. Neither one of them, who have hundreds upon hundreds, and they've released thousands back onto the street, illegals with criminal records. Because it's not vogue. It doesn't work to serve the purpose of the Democratic Party as it relates to the safety and security of, yes, what I thought we should have, the citizen privilege. And I'm not embarrassed to say it. I want it. I want to enjoy it. We deserve it. We've paid for it. We have sacrificed for it. How in the hell have we lost sight of what this is all about? We do not pay, and I said this a number of times as sheriff. A lot of people didn't like it. I didn't really care. But we do not pay the men and women of law enforcement, the first responder community, to be spit on, to be kicked, to have snowballs thrown in their face, to be pushed around, to be shoved, to be blocked by vehicles, to be run over by vehicles, to be intimidated while they're trying to fulfill the mission of that law enforcement agency. We don't pay them for that. And each and every one of those individuals should be put in jail. The problem is, they're completely and totally outnumbered. So who's third in line to ensure that these kind of things don't happen? The Minneapolis Police Department. This guy, Mayor Jacob Fry, is an idiot. Threatening ICE, telling them to get the F out of Minneapolis, calling whatever it is that they do BS, fanning the flames. He's the one causing chaos and distrust. They're the ones that are telling folks to put their bodies on the line, to disrupt. And to intervene in an otherwise legal activity. The investigation relative to the immigration status of certain individuals. We have lost our minds. You will recall that when constitutional sheriffs refused to enforce handgun laws and firearm regulations in states that made them more severe, I called them out. They collectively said they weren't going to do it. And I said then, this is the beginning of the end. If we're going to start picking and choosing which laws we're going to enforce at that level, the whole basic principle of this country and the way that it operates is now gone. You do not want me as the elected sheriff on a whim to decide which ones I'm going to enforce or which ones I'm not going to enforce. And it gets even worse now. We have judges that are refusing to find people that assault federal officers guilty. The guy that threw the sandwich in the face of the ICE officer. Not guilty, let him walk. What? It's on video. You don't get to do that. And I beg you, put yourself in that position. What would you like to see happen? I'm sure you're going to press charges and you'd like to see the individual suffer the consequences and have justice be served. Don't be misled by this rhetoric of the left, right? That they're the ones that are causing all of this. These folks were hired to enforce those very laws. Now, let's talk about the strategy. This is no new strategy. You've heard me say this before. We assisted and facilitated ICE here for many years. Nobody actually knew about it. We did it. We deported more illegals out of Jefferson Parish than any other jurisdiction per capita during the first 4 years of the Obama administration. Obama was known as a deporter in chief. During his election, he talked about the very same things that Donald Trump talked about during his. But somehow, this became a political issue as it related to votes and as it related to the census and as it related to how we're going to divide up jurisdictions and congressional seats and so forth. And now it's become this political volleyball, and I, for one, am not willing to sacrifice the men and women of the first responder community for the sake of the politics of individuals. These individuals, like Fry, like Waltz, are cowards. And I've been consistent on this as well. Elect people that are willing to consume political capital in order to do the right thing. Do not allow them to stare the obvious in the face and walk around it. You will regret the moment that you do. And when we talk about this issue, you know what we shouldn't do? We shouldn't interject Trump. Because almost every elected president for the last two decades has said the same thing about immigration. Plain and simple. People are saying, oh, you're conflating this. We're not conflating anything, right? And let's talk about what went on in the committee yesterday, which was real interesting. And you've heard me say that our immigration policy has to be devised in a way to ensure the best interests of this country. And what was really compelling is what came out during this hearing. So Brendan Belew, who was a former DOJ prosecutor, was a Democrat witness brought before the House committee yesterday. And Congressman Gill from Texas asked the following questions of this individual. First, does large-scale Somali immigration make Minnesota stronger or weaker? Belew, certainly stronger. Do you know what percentage of Somali-headed households in Minnesota are on food stamps? Belew, no. Gil, 54%. Do you know what that number is for native Minnesota-headed households? Ballou wanted to engage into a discourse about what native households meant. And Gil says, only 7% of non-Somali Minnesotan households were on food stamps. Gil, what percentage of Somali-headed households in Minnesota are on Medicaid? I don't know, Ballou said. Gil tells him the figure is 73%, and compared that to the number of non-Somalis on Medicaid, which is 18%. Gil says that's quite an astounding difference. I think we should agree on that. Gil went on to say that 81% of Somali-headed households were on welfare in general. Of course, Ballou didn't know that. But this whole thing is really makes Minnesota stronger. Gil, let me just ask you, after 10 years of being in the United States, what percentage of Somali immigrant households continue to be on welfare? Ballou, I don't know. The number is 78%, he replied. Gil goes on to say that half of the working age Somalis who have been in the United States for 10 years or more speak English very well. Half. That seems to be pretty low, Gil says, right? It doesn't sound like something that makes our country stronger to me when you collectively look, and I'm ad-libbing, you collectively look at all of these stats. I think most Americans would agree with me on that. Well, this is one American that definitely does. Because I've pointed out before, we have over 40% of U.S.-born citizens living below the federally identified poverty level, and we do a crappy job in setting up a system that makes sense to have those folks reach some level of being able to support themselves and move their lives forward. And we should not be importing more as we face, what, $38 trillion deficit now? Math has no emotion. Then you add to this as to what's going on relative to the fraud that exists in Minnesota. It's all beginning to make sense now, right? About what's happening here. Because they're voting as a block. They're not willing to consume political capital. They're not willing to address this. They're afraid of this particular population because they do vote as a block. And there doesn't want to be any accountability. And separate and apart from that, it's not even just directed now at the Somali population. The Committee on Accountability in Minnesota yesterday revealed that HHS in Minnesota is now manipulating documents during a course of inquiry and investigation in order to cover their proverbial derriere. It seems to me that in Minnesota, we've lost all sense of law and order. In order to give away your tax dollars, they have set up schemes, look the other way, are not embracing accountability, do not want to be intrusive. In fact, some of the whistleblowers were threatened. They were followed. They were attacked in social media for bringing forward the fact that the political infrastructure in Minnesota was looking the other way and allowing these abuses to take place. Incredible. They have a privilege that no one else has. We're willing to risk our political careers, our career in government, doctoring documents, and the like. And then when you talk to them and you challenge them about these findings, they want to blame it on Trump. Interestingly, this investigation started under the Biden administration. And in fact, some of the very convictions that they're trying to blame on Trump didn't happen under Trump. They happened during the Biden administration. But that's their go-to. It's Trump's fault. All of this is Trump's fault. And people are buying it. Doesn't make any sense. Educate yourself. And if you don't think that this will move across the country, you're sadly mistaken. Because already, what they're finding in other states, that ate a smart pill and said, hey, how closely have we looked internally at some of these same programs, all this money that came down during the pandemic, all this money that was here, there, and everywhere, how closely have we looked? They started looking, and guess what they found? Abuse. We ought to be familiar with that, right? Day before yesterday, I think it was revealed that some of these ARPA funds that were set aside for the recruitment and retention bonus for the NOPD, that the money's not there, that was allegedly set aside for that purpose. Where is it? Who decided to change? Where's the accountability? Where's the documentation? How close will we look? But if you're okay with paying more taxes, then it's all good. We don't have to worry about any of this. We'll be right
back. Maybe you like cooking. Maybe you don't. Either way, the new Blue Apron is for you. Because along with our classic meal kits, we're offering new pre-made and one-pan meals to help you get dinner on the table fast. And now there's no subscription needed, so you can just order and enjoy. Do delicious food your way. Shop 100-plus meals at blueapron.com. Get 50% off your first two orders with code APRON50. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Amy McCarron, who will be the District A New Orleans City Council member on Monday. And during her campaign, she said a couple of things that really drew my interest, talking about broken roads, violent crime, constant flooding, persistent blight, that these are things that need to be top priorities. And she also said that we make progress by relentlessly holding government accountable where it counts, in our neighborhoods and in its wallets. Amy, welcome to the show and congratulations on your election.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
So, Amy, I guess the anticipation's growing. We're getting closer and closer to Monday. I know a little bit about you, and I would imagine that you are chomping at the bit.
Yes, I am. I was just having a conversation today that, and if you can hear, my voice is a little scratchy because I've been meeting with people and talking way too much this week in anticipation for Monday. So I'm just ready to get started, ready to move in, and ready to, you know, get these things going that we talked about during the campaign that, you know, Helena campaigned on, that all of us campaigned on. So I'm really, really excited.
In this period of transition since the election, obviously, you have a finance background. You're a numbers girl, so to speak, and I say that with respect. How disappointing has it been just to watch some of this unwind? And the other day when I interviewed Helena Moreno, she said it's been eye-opening as to how much we did not know of what was going on inside the finances of the city of New Orleans.
Yeah, it's very disappointing, especially, I mean, you know, I was Joe's policy and budget director for 3 years. And, you know, initially, I think I talked about this when I came on your show during the campaign, that, you know, I went back and looked at all their past reports and I'm like, gosh, did I miss something? And I went back over the last few years and no, I mean, the reports that we received, we didn't miss anything. And so it's been really disappointing and upsetting to see that this is how this outgoing administration has treated the city of New Orleans taxpayers by, you know, misleading the council. And, you know, I'm confident with this new administration, with me having, I'm going to be on the budget committee with Joe coming in as the CAO, that we're going to get it right. And that's a promise that we've made to the citizens and the taxpayers of New Orleans. We have a lot of work to do. I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. That's what I've talked to, you know, over this transition period. I've gone to multiple neighborhood meetings and talked to them about, you know, look, we're not sugarcoating anything. It's going to be hard. There's going to be tough decisions coming forward. But I think that we all know what the mistakes have looked like in the past and how we are going to not make those same mistakes again.
In these meetings, how do you interpret the mood of your constituents? What are they saying? What are they feeling?
So actually, it's surprisingly, most constituents that I've talked to and just people in general are very, very excited about the incoming administration. Everybody has been very tired of the last 4 years. That's a given. You know that. You've heard that. But it's been really actually inspiring because people are really excited about it. They know that from what they have seen through the campaign and through the transition, that everyone seems to be on the same page, at least initially. Obviously, like, I can't guarantee that we're not all going to have, you know, disagreements at times about different things, but everyone is mostly excited that it's time to move forward. We're ready to move forward. We're ready to see what this next administration and council can do.
Now, you have the benefit of having, you know, kind of been in the game for a number of years. What do you, for your district, what do you see as the top three priority items?
So the top three priority items are infrastructure. Obviously, we received that FEMA six month extension, which obviously is not enough time to get things done. So that's something that I'm going to be pushing and working directly with the new administration on. What are our plans? What projects? Clearly understanding what projects are going to get finished within that 6 months, and then what is our plan going forward for the rest of the projects that are slated to get done, you know, having that situation of like, well, if we don't get a new extension, what is the plan? And if we do get a new extension, what is the plan? You know, the other aspect of that plan is, I think it's no secret that there are also projects that were supposed to be funded that don't have any money for FEMA and they don't have bond project funding. You know, I talked to Steve Nelson the other day and I said, what are we going to do to provide some relief for these streets that, you know, they're really bad streets, but we know that they're not going to get a full reconstruction. So, you know, he and I are really going to sit down and talk about, you know, if it costs $200,000 to just pave a street where you have the volcano, like the volcano I have in front of my house, how can we provide relief for people so they can get down their streets if we're not going to be doing reconstruction? So that's going to be a major point of, you know, the next few years for me, is getting those projects on board. The other thing is that I talked about a lot during the campaign is streetlights. There are certain neighborhoods in the district that just don't have enough streetlights. We did a pilot program where we put up solar powered streetlights on Moss Street. I would like to see how we can work to do that, to provide additional lighting to make people feel safe in their neighborhoods when they're getting out of the car at night, that they have enough streetlights in the neighborhood. So that's one of the other big things that I think we're going to make sure. And also, obviously, with new, you know, Michael Harrison coming in over deputy mayor of criminal justice, I'm anxious to see how that's going to work, that coordination between NOPD, fire, and all the other aspects of the criminal justice system, and making sure that, you know, our crime is down, but making sure it stays that way, making sure that we're taking the right steps to move that forward.
I was kind of interested in one particular item that I don't hear discussed much, but I know it's been a challenge to be able to fund. And I know you worked on the, you know, with Joe on the budget committee. The legacy costs of the funding of the pension systems in the city of New Orleans. Have you looked at that, and have we been able to provide the necessary dollars there to try and shore those programs up? It's been a challenge for a long time.
Yes, it's been a challenge for a long time. I haven't been briefed on that quite yet, but that's one of the top five things that I want to talk to Joe about when we get in is figuring that out, because that is important. It's been a huge cost burden. It's something that we owe, but also we need to figure out how we're going to make that work. So I don't have a lot on that at this point, but that's on the top of the list.
So when we look at this situation that we're dealing with right now with the recruitment and retention bonus plan, and we talk about the expenditure of these ARPA dollars, am I overstating this when we say that, you know, this money was allegedly set aside, it's not there now, so, you know, then where is it? I mean, how did we, you know, spend it on something else? I mean, you have to document all of these things, and it seems as though this administration, they give a number between 8 and 12 million. It doesn't even, they seem like they can't even figure out who's entitled to this bonus.
Right. Yes. That's something that we're going to have to figure out as a council, figure out what.
I mean, am I overstating this? I mean, it just seems to me like we got a big problem here.
Yeah, no, I don't think you're overstating it. I mean, that's been something that we planned out when we were doing the ARPA dollars, that, you know, these recruitment and retention bonuses were going to be given out, and this was going to be 2026 was going to be the last year that it was going to be given out. So we're going to have to figure out what happened to those dollars. I mean, we're going to have to figure out where it went. And then I know that we're trying to work on a plan to see if we can have that come out of the payroll funds. But, you know, I mean, that's only part of the problem. The other problem is what happened.
Yeah, and the legislative auditor made an interesting observation, saying, well, if you pay for it out of the payroll funds, you know, you backed into that number trying to cover so many payrolls based on your revenue stream. That now gets disrupted, right?
Right. Yeah, so we're going to have to look at that and see, you know, how that works out. I mean, you know, hopefully we won't have to have this revenue stream for you know, a significant number of years. But, you know, we are going to have to figure out how that looks going forward, because we're going to have to still pay people, and we're going to, you know, people are going to be furloughed at this point. And, you know, I know that the administration is actively trying to not have additional layoffs than what we've already had to do. But, you know, we've got to see how it looks like with these continued furloughs and figuring that part out. Because, you know, we made that promise to the officers that this bonus was coming. I mean, and a lot of it is, especially the recruitment ones, you know, we said if you stuck around here for a couple of years and you went through all these things, that you were going to be getting these bonuses. So, you know, and we have seen that it has worked with some of the retention of our officers. So we're going to have to figure that out in the next, you know, first quarter of budget meetings, of figuring out what happened and then how we move forward and make sure that everybody's getting paid correctly.
Do you think that there's this momentum in talking to your peers and the new incoming council to make the cuts necessary? You know, as I look at revenues and I look at expenditures and the breakdown of the budget, I did some back of the envelope calculations. I think y'all are at around 5,000 employees. I don't see the budget supporting much more than about 3,750 employees. I mean, that's a lot of folks that got to go. Have y'all begun to look at that to see, you know, exactly what these numbers are, what the employee-related benefit expenses are and everything else there? You know, the beauty of that retention bonus is that it didn't increase the base of their salary. So when you had all of this anticipated overtime, when you increase the base, you're increasing your spend, right? Because overtime number goes
right
up.
Yeah. I mean, I know that Joe in the CAO's office has been looking at employees and benefits, and he actually told me, like, we hadn't rebid out our health insurance for employees in at least 8 years. So that's something that I know that they're going to look at.
Wait,
look
say
at
that again.
Employee benefits.
Y'all have not?
Like, correct.
8 years?
At, yeah.
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. So it's just been the same, like, this whole time. So That's something I know. And I
does the city not have does the city not have a consultant that, they work with on that? I mean, we review that every year. Every year.
I know. I don't know the answer to that one. I don't know the answer to that one. But I know that it's something that Joe is looking into as CAO. As far as the employees, you know, I know that, look, I talked about this during the campaign. Helena talked about this during the campaign. We do a lot of outside contract work. So that is where a lot of our expenses come, especially for my, I'm going to go back to my example of streetlights. You know, we have two electricians that work for the city, and we outside contract everything else. And it costs us a lot more money, even when you count in all the employee benefits and that sort of thing. So, you know, those contracts are going to be up in for renewal or revisiting in the middle of the year. So I know that the incoming DPW director is committed to figuring out how we can actually hire people in-house and save money on those things, because it's easier, we're more nimble, we're able to get things done quicker for people if we can have some of these in-house things. And I do think that we can get to that point. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's something that we need to work towards. I mean, it's important for our budget, for our city, for the future, for providing the basic services for residents.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us again. Congratulations on your election. We're very excited about your service to the city of New Orleans. I think you bring a skill set that the council needs and will benefit from. And so we look forward to working with you. And anytime, if you've got something that you want to say to your constituents or to the taxpayer and the citizens of New Orleans, feel free, give me a shout. We'll get you on.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Same goes to you. Let me know if you need me on any time. Happy to do it.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. Amy McCarron, who was the incoming City Council District Member A. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Lines.
Why does every recipe I try need 18 ingredients, including a jar of something paste I'll never use again but will sit in my fridge for 9 months? I just want dinner in the oven, fast. That's why I love Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals. They send you fresh ingredients that are already chopped. All you do is put it all together and bake. That's it. No chopping, no weird leftovers, just delicious, easy-to-make meals. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Stay with us. Well, that was a revelation when you talk about you haven't reviewed your health care plan that's being offered by the city of New Orleans in 8 years. I hope that's not right. You have to structure that plan. You look at your peers in your geographic area, where they stand, where the private corporations are. You try to stay competitive because you don't have, you know, the dollars necessary to continue to fund it. Over the last 10 years, there's been a 52% increase in healthcare costs. So over the last 8 years, I would say it's north of 40% increase. And if you're not modifying and structuring your health plan appropriately and taking advantage of a lot of opportunities that you have with new programs being offered by the federal government, you're not doing, and you're not fulfilling your fiduciary obligation. I mean, this is crazy. This is a major expense item. Benefit packages, you know, are anywhere in some areas, including pensions, 35% to 55%. So for every dollar that you pay in salary, you could have as much as 55 cents in benefits on that dollar. And you've got to manage and massage that very carefully every year, because the only opportunity that you have is a growing economy, which we've not had. We've had out-migration of population, or rolling your millage forward on your property taxes to account for inflation. Because we're only talking about medical inflation. We're not even talking about regular inflation. And You know, so everything ends up costing more. And if you don't account for that annually and you're not getting your thumb and your hands all over that issue internally as to how you're going to posture your budget and looking at the revenue that's coming in and what you're able to afford, there's no wonder why we find ourselves in the predicament we find ourselves in today, because we're not simply paying attention. Sounding more like a third world country. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Chief Ann Kirkpatrick, the superintendent of NOPD, as well as Russell Richardson, president and CEO of the St. Tammany Economic Development Corporation. And Rafi Goyeneche joins us in the noon hour. A lot coming your way. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Newell on WWL.